You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Rebecca Cutter. Rebecca, it's good to have you here this morning.
Good morning.
So the way we start the show is to just with a big question, who are you? What do we need to know about you as a person to start the conversation? You know, experiences, qualities, labels, whatever you want.
Sure. Well, I was born in northern New York, in the North Country, just above the Adirondacks. And I grew up in that area between there and Syracuse. My mother's an artist. My father was a forest ecologist. He did a lot of work along the eastern Lake Ontario and St. Lawrence River. My parents split up before I was one. And I lived with my mother for a while until she had some health problems. And I went to live with my father. So I grew up with my father up in the Adirondacks. And that really shaped who I am as a person, as an artist and an ecologist and an activist. I ended up at age 24 moving to Latin America. I lived in Latin America for 15 years. I lived in Guatemala. And 5 years ago, I relocated to Ithaca. And I have a background in fine arts, a background in education, and a background in ecology and sustainability, I guess you'd say.
Wow. Yeah. That is a fascinating set of circumstances, experiences. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Me too.
You brought some music, and we're going to start with Fleetwood Mac's Secondhand News. Do you want to say anything about it or just play
it? Yeah, well, everyone in my family is, they're all very musical except for myself. And so I had to contact my sister and say, what were the songs of our childhood? Because I couldn't remember the names of the artists. And so my sister started singing songs. And I'm like, yeah, that one. So I did choose a few songs from the 70s that I remember hearing as sort of the backdrop to my childhood.
Yep. So here we go. Fleetwood Mac, Secondhand News.
Yeah.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest is Rebecca Cutter. So Rebecca, just tell me a bit about, you have a fascinating story in terms of the broad overview you just gave us. What are some of the experiences that helped to shape who you are and what you value and what you do?
Right. So going back into my childhood, I think definitely coming from a family where my parents split up at such a young age, I don't really have any childhood memories of sort of the united mother-father unit.
The stereotypical
unit, right?
Nuclear family.
Yeah. And then
it blew up before you came.
Exactly. Exactly. And my mother, unfortunately, has struggled with mental health issues her whole life. Mm-hmm. And quite a few members of my family actually have. So that has definitely shaped my understanding of the world and my relationships to people and to family. So the mental health picture, and then later in life, some of the mental health led into some substance abuse, and not for me personally, but for people close to me.
Right.
So that's something that's really shaped my life experience, having close family members struggling with mental health and, right, and drug addiction.
And what do you feel like you have learned or come to accept or learned how to deal with because of that exposure?
Well, it's been really challenging for me. It's probably one of the biggest challenges for me because I experienced it at a very personal level, so I have some resentment around it. And
yeah,
some
Why frustration, couldn't you be there? Yeah.
Resentment, frustration, and then also it sparks compassion. And trying, it's like my, it's my area for growth, like to be compassionate and to be loving and caring with those relatives and really wanting to be there for them and take care of myself at the same time.
Right. And to be honest about both the need for compassion and the frustration, the resentment, the losses that this brings to you.
Yeah.
That you feel.
Yeah.
Wow. So that helps kind of explain how you ended at a time where many people didn't grow up with their fathers. That's how you...
I grew up with my father, and he was wonderful. Both of my parents are really amazing. My father did die about a year ago, mm-hmm. And he was just an amazing person. He really challenges the notion of the role men can play, mm-hmm, in raising children. He was just very amazing. I was so fortunate.
What did you do? What did you come to appreciate through your relationship with him that is important?
Oh gosh. Well, incredible person of integrity. He was quite strict with us as children. We grew up with very little access to television or, mm-hmm, sweets or sugars or soda or anything like that. And he was an ecologist, so he would make us do like mud hikes in the rain. And
were tagging along, or because he wanted
to have
the experience?
No, because that's his idea of how to raise a child. Uh-huh. It's raining, yep, put your boots on, we're going on a mud hike.
Yep.
Many, many, many trips camping, plant identification, canoeing in the Adirondacks. Just a beautiful childhood. We had an open door policy. We lived in a very working class neighborhood. Nothing was fancy. I think we had a plastic coffee table, but we never locked our doors, and I was allowed to wear my roller skates in the house, and we had a stream of neighborhood kids in and out of the house, mm-hmm, at all times. So it was really a very beautiful childhood. I mean, it was very rough in the sense that I went through the divorce and a custody battle and then the mental health stuff with my mother and my sister. And
is your sister older?
Yeah, she is. Okay. She is. She's a musician. My mother's an artist. Very creative, beautiful people.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a community leader. He worked on preserving wetland areas and coastal areas, riparian areas, land management in the Adirondacks. Did a ton of volunteer work after he was retired. Certainly a person I'm very proud of.
Yeah. And having just died a year ago, the loss is still quite immediate.
Yeah.
So where did you, how did that launch you? I mean, those are two, yeah, really incredibly powerful life-shaping experiences. How were you prepared or not to mm-hmm. meet the world when you came of age?
Yeah, well, okay, another thing that really influenced me was I was raised in the Unitarian Universalist Church, mm-hmm. and my family on my dad's side is fifth generation Unitarian Universalist, so it's not just in the church.
150 years back.
Yeah, exactly. So a long history of those particular values, and so I was never told that I had to believe in God, for example, mm-hmm. sure. you know. And I grew up in a very white community, but with very liberal ideas. So when I was 17 and graduated from high school, I went to art school because I was under the influence of my mother's artistic talents. Mm-hmm, sure. And I went to art school, graduated from Pratt Institute with a degree in fine arts and a teaching degree as well.
Not only art school, but you went to the city.
Yeah. I did a two-year foundation school at Munson Wims Proctor Institute in Utica first, which is an amazing small foundation art school that I highly recommend to people who want to go to art school, don't want to spend a ton of money, want to learn the basics of you know, printing and everything, sculpture to drawing to painting wow. to welding to photography, everything. It was a great school. But after graduation, I moved out west and I struggled to try to create a career for myself in art. And very funny long story about how I ended up in Guatemala, but it sort of connects back to how I ended up in Ithaca. I met someone after going on a long tour of colleges. I wanted to go back to college for sustainability. I wanted to go to get a master's degree. Mm-hmm. Traveled across the country on a road trip, in interviewing at different colleges. Couldn't quite find the program I was looking for. Ended up on the Mendocino County on the coastline there, and ran into someone from the Finger Lakes of all places, who said, oh, if you're interested in sustainability, you should go to Guatemala. And not only should you go to Guatemala, you should go to this village, San Lucas Toliman. There's a program there where you can volunteer and live there for free and eat and do this great work and learn all about this. And you should meet my friend, Ronaldo Leck. He's doing this kind of work that you want to do. So I said, okay, I'm going to go. I'm going to go. And he said, think about it. And he said, no, I'm going. And I raised some money. I worked a landscaping job and went down there with $500. And I ended up staying for 15 years. And I ended up marrying Ronaldo Leck and co-founding two organizations with him down there. So that's where the sort of ecology, community development, my father's side of me came out. And I just became very passionate about social justice and solidarity work with grassroots organizations in Latin America.
Mm-hmm. And can you share the name of the person who told you about
that? Sure. His name is Dominic Moretti, and Amanda Moretti is a dancer and a member of our community here.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there's a woman I interviewed on the show who did work in Guatemala too, that I was wondering if that was also, there are lots of connections.
I ended up moving to Ithaca because so many people from the Finger Lakes region have gone down there, particularly during the winter, uh-huh. and they would volunteer in the programs that my ex-husband and I co-founded. So I would see them winter after winter. Yes. And then when I would come up to visit my family, I would swing through Ithaca with my daughter. And we started to develop this really beautiful, organically growing community uh-huh. of friends in Ithaca. So when it was time to move up here so that my daughter could go to high school in the U.S., mm-hmm. we knew that Ithaca was the place for us. We already had an established community of friends.
Right. I want to go back to that moment when you're in Mendocino and you say, I'm going. What about that moment? What about you made that kind of devotional statement?
Well, I was at a crossroads in my life. I had graduated with this BFA and spent a year mm-hmm. living in Seattle trying to make it. I think I had five jobs that year. I was working with Dale Chihuly, the glass blower, and substitute teaching art in schools and, you know, anything and everything I could do to make a living. Yeah, yeah. And I was really ready to delve into my other passion, which was more of the ecology and community development work. And so when he said, you can learn all of this by doing it in Guatemala, right. I said, okay, I'm there. And the funny thing is, I didn't even really know where Guatemala was on the map. But, you know, as soon as I got home, I looked it up. I went to the library. I started reading Rigoberta Menchú books and learning about the history. And I landed in Guatemala 4 days before they signed the peace accords.
So you went down not even knowing that that was going
to
be...
I knew that they were about to sign the peace accords because I was putting myself... I was getting myself. Yeah. Oh, no, well.
They were far enough along in the peace process that you,
exactly. You could trust it. Yeah, yeah. So I was there to witness that historic moment. And it's just, Guatemala is one of those countries that gets under your skin. And I don't think I'll ever stop going there.
Right. You, what you have described, and I just want to take a little bit of a footnote thing. The opportunity to learn experientially,
yes,
which
exactly.
is like how you were raised on some sense,
yeah.
was more compelling than the academic route.
Yeah.
And we don't, as a culture, know well how to cultivate people who are really experiential learners. We don't know how to invite them into the experiences. We don't honor that as a kind of, it's almost a, it's learning a craft or it's learning more in a craft style of learning. And we don't do that well, but you responded instantly to the offer, and it was made in a way that spoke directly to what you needed.
Yeah, and funny you should say that, because in my second year in Guatemala, I got married, and then the next year I had my child, Ischel, mm-hmm. who's a member of this community. She's an up-and-coming activist herself.
Uh-huh.
So I began taking my daughter to work with me. I worked with women. I found that there was a need to work with women. There were very few women involved in the civil society organizations that I was supporting. And I got invited to a popular education seminar workshop. And I said, yeah, I'll go. And I was the only foreigner in the workshop. It was designed for campesinos. And it's a very radical approach to pedagogy. And it really clicked with me, with my values being raised in the UU church. And then it also clicks with permaculture, which is something that I get very involved in Guatemala. So it all clicked together like pieces of a puzzle. And then basically I began practicing popular education, and that is my passion. And it is in some ways experiential learning, but it's sort of much more than that.
Sure, sure.
That's been what I've basically been devoting myself to since then.
And you know, what I see is the ecological framework gives you a systematic approach. And then when you've worked with materials as an artist, you know how things, what you can do and what you can't do with certain things and how to push them. That would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I grew up in an indigenous America, not in that term, but the first major religious tradition founded on U.S. soil, a version of Christianity, which led to the populist revolt of the 1870s, the cooperativist rural movement, the Christian anarchists, of the first interracial congregations and marriages that were kind of in the South, even in the years after the Civil War. So I grew up in a kind of stance apart, and the people in my woman in my congregation was elected mayor in 1930, 10 years after suffrage, you know, passed.
Wow.
And so, I mean, and 70 years before Ithaca had a woman mayor. I mean, it's kind of funny. This is in Northwest Missouri. We don't think about rural areas like the northern New York area.
Right.
The pocket you describe as being liberal or open, I'm not sure whether it was kind of structurally liberal or just people who are really open. In terms of the way you describe the place you were from in northern New York, because that's not the stereotype
of
the
North Country. No, it's not. It's not. And it was, again, it was like probably an entirely white congregation as well.
And the community that you, the congregation is a synonym for community for
right,
you in that moment.
Right.
So not necessarily the working class neighbors that you were with, but the place where you went for the congregational life. The
meaning, the
reflection.
Sort of spiritual.
Sure.
Training, if you will. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that helps to, our communities are much more complex oftentimes than certainly of stereotypes, but we don't almost know how to draw out that the uniqueness of each little micro community that we are involved in.
That's true.
What should we play next?
I don't know how we're doing for time.
We got plenty. We're going to have plenty of time.
How about we play the Victor Jara song? And this is for my daughter. This is a song I sang to her as she was growing up.
Yep. It's a very famous one.
Mm-hmm. duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo. Negrito, duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo. Negrito, te va a traer codornices
para ti.
Te va a traer ricas frutas
para ti.
Te va a traer carne de cerdo
para ti.
Te va a traer mucha cosa
para ti.
Y si negro no se duerme, viene diablo blanco y ¡zas!
Le come la patita y
yacapumba, yacapumba, apumba, yacapumba, yacapumba, yacapumba.
Duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo. Negrito, duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo. Negrito,
trabajando,
trabajando duramente,
trabajando, sí.
Trabajando y va tosiendo,
trabajando, sí.
Trabajando y no le pagan,
trabajando, sí.
Trabajando y va de luto,
trabajando, sí.
Pa'l negrito chiquitito,
trabajando, sí.
Pa'l negrito chiquitito,
trabajando, sí. Va de luto, sí. Va tosiendo, sí. No le pagan, sí. Duramente, sí.
Duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo. Negrito, duerme, duerme, negrito, que tu mamá está en el campo.
Negrito. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Rebecca Cutter. So, Rebecca, you know, tell us a little bit about your daughter and raising a child in Guatemala.
Okay. Well, her name is Ixchel.
Which means?
Ixchel is the Mayan goddess of the moon and also of medicine. And when I was pregnant with her, I was living in a renovated silo on a farm with her dad, and we were reading a book together about the Mayan cosmology, which is something I became very interested in living there. And they talked a lot about Ixchel in the book, and when we got to the end, there was a glossary of names, and when we read the name Ixchel, we looked at each other and said, yep, this is a girl that we're carrying, and that's her name. And there was never any question about whether it was going to be a girl or not and what the name would be.
Wow.
So, yeah, she's here in Ithaca, and she works at the Multicultural Resource Center. She's a really powerful person. She's very creative and very passionate about racial justice. She is really more than bicultural. She's Maya Kakchikel and also Latina and also from my family, from my roots, my European roots.
Yes, yes, yes.
So, and she maneuvers and manages it quite beautifully. Yeah, she's a very interesting person.
What have you longed for her to experience based on your coming up and coming to know what you value in life? What have you longed for her to experience?
Well, I think from my roots, what I really wanted her to experience was the connection to nature that sometimes we take for granted here in Guatemala, for example. You can't just go camping.
Right.
It's not safe, or there might not be a place to go camping.
Right.
Or camping is kind of frivolous in some ways for some people who are just struggling hand to mouth.
Yeah.
So this connection to nature. Also, there's so many freedoms that we enjoy here in the U.S. that we don't have in Guatemala. And I think she's really learning to tap into those and appreciate those and go to music festivals and community events and enjoy herself and, you know, dance freely and dress as she wants to and and express herself with that kind of freedom that we have here. And I'm happy that she has that.
Right, right. And also because of her roots to really to love and respect and hold on to that too.
And she does. And she really does.
Yeah.
She spends a lot of time in Guatemala. She's very close. She has a huge extended Guatemalan family. And they pretty much adore her. She's a real link between two cultures. She honors and respects them, and they see that. And it's really paid off for her in long-lasting, beautiful relationships with her relatives there.
Neat.
Yeah.
Neat. So what was the move like? What?
Oh, God.
How was the move?
Well, it was really weird. I'll try to tell you the story as briefly as possible. But basically, I was having a very hard time for many years making the decision to move back. I think I was quite terrified of the transition from Guatemala to the U.S. Mm-hmm. Much of the work we were doing in Guatemala was with people who are clearly oppressed. And a lot of their oppression is because we have freedoms and rights and possibilities in this country because essentially we are repressing others. And so I was working with those others who, you know, who were being impacted by trade agreements and mass immigration to the U.S. Right. for economic reasons. So for me to move here with my daughter was ideologically difficult for me.
To side with the oppressor.
In some ways, like that, or even more challenging, to work with people from my own country, which I knew I needed to do.
Right.
And I was terrified to do it. For a lot of deep reasons that we don't have time to get into now. But I knew I needed to leave the foreign country and move back to my country and do the kind of work I was doing there here. Mm-hmm. There was just a lot of fear wrapped up in it. But I went to a dental clinic and the Cuban dentist said he was injecting me to do some kind of dental work while I was up here for a visit. And he was lecturing me on how I've spent far too much time in Latin America. It's time for me to move home. And inadvertently, he damaged the nerve in my jaw. And I ended up with trigeminal neuralgia.
Oh, no.
And then the dentist, finally, I get to Ithaca and I see Ira Camp, wonderful dentist. And he says, oh, well, you have nerve damage and you're not getting on an airplane for another 3 months. So we missed our flight back. I had to run around, scurry around and enroll Ishel in school. And this is how the decision basically got made for us after years of indecision. And I'm grateful in a way because sometimes life just throws circumstances at you that are unexpected but work to your advantage.
Right, right. And force you to do what you didn't have the courage or the resolve to do.
But it was really hard for my daughter. It was hard for both of us, but it was particularly hard for her because it was so unexpected. Mm-hmm. She was already enrolled in school down there. We were supposed to get on an airplane in a few days. And when the doctor said, no go, you're not going anywhere. So it was an imposition on her. She missed her family. It was really hard. It took about 3 years of transition.
Yeah.
And now she's awesome. She's doing amazing.
Yeah. I mean, to do it in 3 years is still pretty quick to make that kind of about face, even though I imagine she knew that it was looming as a possibility on the horizon.
Yeah.
Wow. So I want to switch back to what your passion in Guatemala and where you've taken it in terms of popular education. But let me just, since we're about the bottom of the hour, let me do the station ID. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest is Rebecca Cutter. So how has your commitment to empowerment, commitment to popular education developed over the years?
Well, when I first got to Guatemala, and I didn't speak the language, I was just learning Spanish. I moved in with a family. I expedited the process by putting myself into a complete immersion situation. I was also learning a little bit of Caxiquel. I was living with indigenous Maya Caxiquel people. I got thrown into the sort of, we're establishing an organization, we're writing grants to do projects for people. So without having any background in development, I started basically doing community development work. This is before I got a master's degree in it. So I did it for about 8 years before going to get a degree in it. And after several years of watching how development programs play out, and then having taken that workshop in popular education, I came to the conclusion that, you know, the only people who can free the oppressed are the oppressed. And the role, and that my role in that country was a role of solidarity with the oppressed. And then I discovered that the only way I could go about it that I felt comfortable was through using education as a tool for social change. So not as a tool for transferring knowledge, but as a tool for organizing experiences that allow people to look critically at their life circumstances and understand it within a historical context. And then build from there organizations focused on breaking down structures of oppression. And that's what I began dedicating my work to. And fortunately, in the last 4 years I was in Guatemala, I was able to work as a consultant just doing that. Mm-hmm. And I would get hired by organizations, and they would ask me to come in and do sort of a social impact assessment of the impact of their education program. And I would help them sort of reassess their organizational vision and mission. And then how can you use your education program as a tool to reach those goals? So it was pretty radical, because sometimes it would turn the organization upside down. Because often it becomes about the agenda of the organization or the donor, and it's no longer really about the problems of the people and their needs. So it's been an interesting line of work.
Yeah. And most organizations go through what's called goal displacement.
Yes.
Which is over time, they become focused more on perpetuating themselves or those who support them rather than being allied with whatever it is that they were intending to do in the first place. And it gets, it's very hard to remind people that these are the people who matter the most, and listening and engaging.
But also, like, the development industry is an industry that has to create business for itself. And so it's set up and structured in a way that basically perpetuates structures of oppression instead of breaking them down. And so we ameliorate people's discomfort as they live in poverty. And then they don't organize and they don't struggle, because we only find liberation from structures of oppression through struggle, organized struggle. So we have to really be very critical about the way we quote unquote help people.
And most, the role we play. I mean, the development industry is just another service industry. And like most healthcare, if it's not preventative, it's usually ameliorative, and it's not necessarily helping us, and it's not necessarily creating the relationships we need of mutual care.
Right.
And the same way with whether it's the food industry or whatever, these service, heavily service industry places are really ways of choreographing our behavior rather than really considering the lives we ought to live.
Exactly.
And that's
exactly,
you know, you pose that issue pretty clearly. Thank you. And you've taken this, where has this work taken you?
I have done popular education work throughout Central America. I've done it in Guatemala and Honduras and Nicaragua and Costa Rica. I used to be the country coordinator for the Central American Solar Energy Project, where I worked with women. I do a lot of permaculture work as well, and the area that I like working with particularly is how to use appropriate technologies like rain catchment tanks, gray water reuse, that kind of thing, solar ovens. Yep. So, but it's all just sort of a pretext for working with women to organize. And that's the really important piece. And when I go back and visit these communities, what I enjoy is talking to the women that I worked with and laughing and talking about how we work together, and then saying, so what are you doing now? And, you know, these are women who are putting their kids through college. And these are women who have gone back to school themselves. These are women who started their own businesses. These are women who are leading organizations, working for their municipalities. And it makes me feel happy that we walk together side by side in a process of human development. My development, her development, we both grew, we both became the people we are today.
And the critical piece is you can both tell the other what you, how they saw him or her change.
Yeah, exactly. But I had an opportunity to work in Palestine with an organization called Ma'an in Ramallah. And I went twice. The first time I was doing a 4-day workshop on popular education. It was the first time I ever taught that workshop in a fancy hotel to people who had master's degrees. And that was really strange for me because usually I'm working with illiterate campesinos in someone's patio of their backyard, you know.
Oppression comes in all sorts of, the experience comes in all sorts of forms.
Yeah, it was really powerful work there. And they invited me back a second time and we developed some case studies. We went to Hebron and Nablus and Belin. And then out of that came an opportunity to facilitate a 4-day symposium on popular education with a Belgian organization, that sort of a socialist organization that was supporting grassroots movements like Arab Spring. Mm-hmm, and we did that in the Sinai Peninsula. We had people from the Gaza Strip attend, and that was the only place they could get to.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Wow, wow.
Yeah.
So how has your practice, how has your practice of popular education and empowerment changed over the years? What have you had to learn that you might not have been so open to, and what have you had to embrace more strongly than you ever imagined?
It's definitely, it's become more political in the sense that when I first began, I had an embarrassing moment in the workshop in Guatemala where everyone around me seemed to understand that education is political and that what we were doing was political. And I had been told by my husband at the time that, you know, we weren't going to get involved in anything political because his father had been disappeared.
Because of politics.
Yeah. During the conflict there. So he was very careful not to get involved in anything that he deemed political. And so I sort of adopted his attitude, and I was in this workshop and I said, no, I'm not going to get involved in anything political. And everyone just stopped and they got quiet and they turned and looked at me like, you don't get it, do you? Education is political, and there's no way that it can't, it can be apolitical. If you don't take a position on the things that you believe in, then you are supporting the status quo. And so this is really hard for people to believe in or to really, it means one thing to say like, oh yeah, I get that. It's another thing to do it.
Right, right, right. And it's incredibly complex to hear everybody's voice in that moment. I grew up in a congregation where there was a superintendent of schools of a nearby school district who lived his entire adult life with another man who was a farmer. In the congregation, they sat next to each other. They even held hands. But they were born around 1900, and they were able to have that kind of relationship as men and not be hammered because people didn't, it was just accepted. It was quiet, but it was accepted. And the woman who was mayor actually spent her entire adult life living with another woman. And she was a, she was the mayor. She was the postmistress when she was 25. She ran the post office for several years. And then 10, 15 years later, she was the mayor. And she said, I can't be an elder in this congregation, but they'll never meet without me, because she had no man in her life to represent her at the governance of the church. And so she just insisted on doing that. But they were totally opposed by people taking a much more in-your-face attitude towards gay and lesbian issues, because they had learned how to create a space that was safe for them and where they were honored. But that space was being lost by a culture that was becoming more hateful.
Wow.
And your husband's story seems like he found a space where he could deal with the politics to save himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to, because he didn't want probably the outcome that has happened to his father.
Yeah.
And so you walked in to this situation and you have a whole different set of things that you have to balance and the commitments to make and keep.
Yeah, and I also am not judgmental of people who don't feel that they can step up politically because they may feel threatened.
Yeah.
They may feel it's unsafe.
Right.
And I grew up in a different situation. I have the sense of possibility that I can do this and nothing will happen to me. You know, so I recognize that some people that's not a position that they can take.
Right. And And for me, the situation that I grew up in became a rural ghetto. Mm-hmm. And so there were people who would be attacked for being different. But then there were also people in the community who said, even my worst enemy needs what it takes to thrive. And we're going to make sure they get what they need. So mm-hmm. the informal structures came into play, even across relationships of enmity or structural inequality. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we learning those skills, which seem to be kind of at the heart of your work,
yeah,
is really powerful.
Yeah.
Let's cut to music and just where would you like to go next if we're going musically?
Oh, gosh.
Well,
what else did I have there?
Before I Rust?
I Rust. This is Driftwood, which is one of my favorite local bands, and I always want to celebrate our local bands.
Here we
love
go.
This song.
Was the live version of Before I Rust by Driftwood at Grassroots in 2013. Our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Rebecca Cutter. So Rebecca, as we kind of go into the last longer segment of the show, the way I like to end the show is to ask people, how have you learned, what do you do? And in your case, because of having lived in such radically different environments, how have you learned to take care of yourself emotionally, physically, intellectually? What do you do? What are the practices on a daily, weekly, monthly, regular basis that you do? And how do you know you need to do them?
I'm kind of laughing because I'm not really very good at it.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, and if most of us are honest, much of the time we're not very good at it, but that doesn't mean it's not important.
Right. So what I've been trying to do, and I think I'm getting better at it, is I've been trying to keep my work. I work at New Roots Charter School. I've been there mm-hmm. for 5 years, ever since I landed here. I'm trying to recreate a new culture around nonprofit work. Uh-huh. Where we take in consideration the person as a whole person who has a life outside of work and who can come into work and give it 100% and then leave at the end of the day without carrying all sorts of baggage of stress and a sense I better check in at night mm-hmm. and I've got to answer emails and I've got to, you know. So just really taking care of myself in that way. I'm doing great work, I know that, but I want to feel good about it too, and I want the people I work with to feel good about it.
What is your role at New Roots?
I'm the Community Learning and Outreach Coordinator. It's kind of an interesting job. I coordinate the arts program. We have a really robust music program, fine arts. We have many drawing, painting, sculpture, studio art, urban art. We have theater. We have African drum and dance. And then we do spoken word. So I coordinate those programs. I also am involved in enrollment. Mm-hmm. And I teach all day on Saturday. I'm sorry, on Tuesdays. I teach drawing and sculpture. And then I teach an internship and service learning class for 11th and 12th graders.
Cool.
It's like any nonprofit. After a while, you start wearing many hats and your job becomes very organic.
And I mean, that's not true of the large nonprofits or of the really, really small focus, single mission. But where you've got a general mission of education and you've got a small school, you're in the thick of it.
Yeah. And I really love working there. It's often referred to as a living laboratory. And it feels that way, not just for the students, but for me as well. Mm-hmm. I've had plenty of opportunities to grow there. I supervise people now, which is always a challenge to, you know, learn how to, you know, not only take care of yourself, but you're trying to help the people that you're supervising take care of their needs mm-hmm. and themselves. And the other thing I do to try to take care of myself is I've been doing a lot more dancing mm-hmm. and try to get physical, riding my bike to work and getting out and getting a chance to really move my physical body and spend time with friends and community and try to laugh as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's... taking care of your body physically helps you with your emotions and your and mm-hmm. the laughter piece. How do you know that you need to do something different? What do you become aware of that says, oh, I need to do a little better self-care here? How do you know?
Well, I'm one of these people who can't say no. I have a really hard time saying no. So I take on more than is usually humanly possible. And then I find myself... descuidando, not taking care of myself. So things
descuidando. Disquieting myself or
not taking care of myself. And things will start to fall apart. And my daughter, who's 18 now she knows me well and she'll sort of point it out to me. You're doing that thing again, Mom. And, you know, the people who are closest to me, my best friends, they'll point it out to me and I'll try to work my way back out and try to create mm-hmm. empty spaces in my schedule and in my life again. I often have these empty spaces and I love them, but they initially throw me into a panic of like, what's this empty space in my life? I've got to fill it. And so I have to really work hard. I love going up to the Adirondacks because once I'm there, there's nothing. There's no internet. There's nothing. There's a book and the wilderness and a river and no organization to attend to, no meeting to organize, just be.
Right. And it's hard to, in a busy, chaotic world, it's hard to say I'm going to make a friend of stillness or I'm going to make a friend of silence. Because you don't know how to embrace what you cannot conjure up in yourself without fear.
Yeah.
And but that does sound like a challenge that you've actually, that you're facing.
I'm working on it. Yeah. It's, life is a long journey of self-improvement and, you know.
And I'm not sure whether it's improvement or not, but it's certainly change.
Well, you don't want to suffer. You're trying not to suffer as much. Problems. So, what can I do to keep doing this good work and also enjoy myself
So, what do you do to promote laughter in your life? You said you emphasize the laughing.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm not very good at telling jokes, I'm told. But I...
But it makes you chuckle.
I don't know. I'm one of these... I have a kind of a perpetual smile on my face. I get great joy out of really simple things in life. Sure. The sun comes up in the morning, I'm happy. You know, it rains, it makes me happy. Yep. You know, the wind blows through the trees, I love that. You know, so it's... I think it's the appreciation of the simple things that keeps me going.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And being a person who is embodied and experiential in your mm-hmm. in your learning and your reflection, it's something that from my experience, when people have that style, which I do too, it's harder sometimes to articulate what it is you actually do because you just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be thrown into a situation where you learn something, or suddenly you're drawn to something, like the way you were called out in California to, mm-hmm. to kind of what the next step was, because that's just kind of the way it works. What I'm wondering, how have you had to fundamentally change in a way that you would not have anticipated or chosen, but it's proven important?
I don't think I can answer this question. I know it was on the list of questions, and it was the one question I thought, wow, I really thought about it. I'm like, how have I had to change? I believe that I am perpetually changing,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and that I've had to change over time. I've had to become more organized. I've had to learn how to say no and to focus and to know that that's okay.
Right.
And
I'm gonna comment on the no piece, and then I'll reframe the question in a way that may be easier. I had to learn how can I say yes in a way that doesn't compromise me, because I don't want to be. I was a negative no sayer for a number of years in my life when I was bitterly disappointed with how things were going, mm-hmm. and I said no reflexively, and so I had to say to myself, how can I say yes in a way that will not compromise me or anyone I love.
Right.
And that, so that became my discipline rather than learning how to say no, because I had been a total yes sayer, had an embittering experience and became a real naysayer, and then had to kind of find a balance. Now, to reframe the question, what has been a hard lesson to learn?
Oh, I think the one around being over dedicated to your causes while raising a child, and then looking back and saying, gee, I wish I had put up more boundaries around what I was willing to get involved in the community, so mm-hmm. that I could have mm-hmm. just had more time with my daughter. Now, that said, she absolutely went everywhere with me. This is a child who went into the field with me. Whenever mm-hmm. I went into the field, she went to all the meetings that I organized. Mm-hmm. It's part of who she is today. But I often look back and wish that I hadn't been so driven in those early... I mean, I had her when I was 25. And from 25 to 35, I co-founded two organizations. Yep. And and that's when she was growing up. And mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. so I guess I look back, and now I'm much more careful about protecting the time and space that I want to have for her and for us and mm-hmm. for family. And friends.
What you describe, she was with you, and you were in a parallel space, but mm-hmm. she didn't have as much of your attention as you would have liked to have for her to have had.
Yeah, she was dropped on my back. Yeah, but you know, it's funny because I was working with Campesino women whose babies were also strapped on their back.
Right.
So in the context that I was living in, she was living in, it was absolutely the most natural thing in the world.
And it wasn't perceived as unfair.
No, not at all. It's part of that shift between like what's considered socially normal here around child rearing and what was considered socially normal there. You know. But anyhow.
But it is a quality of appreciation and regard that you now want to be able to be different.
Well, I just see that raising children is just as important as leading an organization or a movement, mm-hmm. it's just as radical. It's yeah. just as important. And so I think for a parent to say, no, I'm not going to join that committee because I'm raising this child over here, I think you should, like, you know, slap yourself in the back. I think that's a beautiful, wonderful thing to do.
Yeah, and I think people have a hard time doing it because it's also not just a decision that you can make by yourself. It's kind of a decision that you need people around you to kind of help you appreciate and to affirm, because sometimes we pull back when we should step up, and sometimes we step up when we should mm-hmm. pull back. And for me, and this may be more my issue than yours, I needed that input and I didn't get it. And mm-hmm. and I also overworked mm-hmm. for particularly in the life of one of my children. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that I carry that same kind of sense of regret.
We have a lifelong relationship with them, so it's never never too late.
No. And yeah. but it's also something where if regret taints your engaging it, then it can't be fresh. There needs to be a start over, a restart. And that's one of the things that I'm learning.
I try not to have regrets. I look at life like life is painful and beautiful, and the depth of the beauty is correlational to the depth of the pain. And we have a life experience. We're working through a lot of things that happened in our childhood. And I try not to look back with regret on the decisions I've made.
Right, right.
And the things I've done, and I've just learned from them.
Yes. And I think just the way you framed it was you have resolved the question, and the question may have pushed some issues, because the changing isn't that you would dismiss it or let it go, but that painful experience led you to something else,
yeah,
which is of greater value or of at least as important that you wouldn't have otherwise gotten.
Right.
And that's yet another way of framing the same. You just said it beautifully. Mm-hmm. Rebecca, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you, Eric.
We're going to close. Do you want to say something about this last song?
What is the last song?
It's the...
Kemei. So Kemei is my Nahual. So I follow the Mayan cosmology, and it's very animist. It's very based on nature and the interconnectedness of humans with nature at a real spiritual level. So this is a song that was written by René Dionisio, who's hopefully going to be visiting Ithaca soon. He's just coming off a European tour and landing in New York City today. So this is the song of the day of Kemei.
Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca.
Para renacer, dame la alegría, el buen proceder. Es música placer. De la nada, saben lo que va a pasar. Si no lo entendés, ni al derecho ni al revés. Es el que te guía, aunque no lo ves. Cuando canta, los muertos se levantan. Oshlahu es la energía que me guía. Cósmica es mi lírica bien pensativa. Es mi lírica bien, bien nativa. Hey, you know what I mean. Watch this. Oscuridad.
magia desconocida con gran poder. Signo del oculto, misterios por resolver. Nacer, crecer, morir, cambio, renacer. No digo adiós, nos volveremos a ver. Came son los huesos, el parto, la mujer. Espiritualidad es la clave a proceder. Gracias, Came, por la vida, la muerte. Perdón, que me venimos a trascender.
Came, lo único seguro y certero es que un día nací y otro día me muero. Verdaderos mensajeros desde el inframundo, magos enlazadores de ombligos de mundos, sin miedo a lo profundo ni a la maldad.